listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 145 is Jay Gonzalez, a multi-instrumentalist best known for his work as keyboardist for the Drive-By Truckers, which he joined in 2008. You're right now listening to Tough to Let Go from their latest album, The New OK. He's from New York. He was a band called Love Apple in the 1990s, moved to Athens and was in The Possibilities there. And then in a spinoff, Nutria, he joined the Truckers in 2008. He's been there for 6 albums. While he wrote and sang songs for some of those bands, his solo career started with Mess of Happiness 2012, then an EP in 2015, and now 2021's Back to the Hive. We'll be talking about the title track of that album, then listening to the last 2 songs in the EP Bittersweet 2015, and then Turning Me On from that 2012 debut, Mess of Happiness. And we'll conclude by listening to I Want to Hold You from the new album. For more information, please see jgonzalez.com. For more about this podcast, please look to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you want to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Not only can you avoid hearing me read ads, but you'll get my episode notes, which is lyrics, things I found interesting in the arrangements, some questions I used for the interview. And in this case, there's actually bonus footage, additional discussion that I had with Jay, just for the supporters. So I will have played a little of Tough to Let Go from the latest Drive-By Truckers album, The New OK 2020, as the intro, which is not one you wrote, but has a prominent keyboard part by you at the beginning. This is the reason why we're hooked up, because through that connection, you said you've been writing since you were 14, but have only within the last decade or so kind of emerged as a full-on solo recording artist, but still obviously a very useful sideman to have around.
I think that's my strong suit, probably, is being able to play off somebody's songs and just add little bits and pieces in there, as opposed to sort of being able to improvise or shred over anything. I really like decorating the songs, but it's nice to also, you know, work on my own stuff and try to do it all together.
Well, I see this may exemplify how useful you are as a sideman, that you have given me actual sheet music for the songs that we're covering.
Yeah, I'm a nerd like that. I took piano lessons when I was a kid, and I studied guitar in college. And when I moved to Athens right after school, I just kind of promptly went back to doing everything completely by ear. And then I started collecting like old sheet music and really enjoying just playing the chords, not necessarily playing the actual arrangements. But when I did the Bittersweet, I thought it was a nice, I was also doing a Kickstarter thing, so it was a nice extra thing. And then the minute I started getting into it, I realized that I was in over my head, and I was amazed I could finish it. Looking through it today, I realized there's already a few errors in there, but you know.
So the Bittersweet, that has actual keyboard parts as well as the melody. The stuff for the new album, it looks like you just wrote down the notes of the melody, which hardly anybody ever does, because like people can remember the melody. Like you just listen to it and...
But that's like a loss. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with going to library or like used bookstores and getting collections of like 1001 favorite songs of 1970s, you know, and then also like any kind of fake book. I love that, because I prefer that. I'm generally just going to read the chords and maybe the melody if I don't know the song. And a lot of times to get inspired, I'll just pull out one of the many fake books I've collected and just try play through songs I don't actually know and see if I can kind of get it in there. But I think it's a little easier just to do the chords and the melody, and most people aren't going to play through the actual piano arrangement these days. I mean, I think I was taking piano lessons in 1980. I was at the tail end of that, probably, if it was even a thing at that point, you know.
By the mid to late 80s, when I was having my first bands in high school, I thought, you always hear the stories of like, oh yeah, I would just ear train from my records, which I did that too, of course, but like the first time I was in a band, I thought you had to, you know, I was coming out of orchestra and stuff, and my piano player was coming out of piano lessons. So we ordered sheet music for the songs that we wanted to cover. I have sheet music for Benjamin Orr's Too Hot to Stop, the Cars solo spinoff project.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's
weird.
It's weird, but it's great. And I love classic sheet music is great from the 30s and 40s with the great artwork. And then as it got into the 70s and just became more of like just taking the picture, just a press photo. And then at some point I'd like to do like an easy piano book too, because I had like the Billy Joel easy piano, you know, where it's just like two mel, you know, the bass line and then the melody in the key of C. And My piano teacher was really good, but she didn't teach me, or I don't recall her teaching me. I also might have blocked it out, but sort of chord theory and 1-4-5 and like improvising or anything like that. And when my 15-year-old kid took piano lessons a few years ago, the piano teacher, she'd just play like a, you know, a chord and then he'd give him the scale and he would just improvise. And you could just see the excitement, you know, it's just like, oh, this is great. So I love the formality of music instruction, but at the same time, it's, and I think as I get older, I'm like, I've written some horn charts for the Truckers in the past. That kind of got me back into it. And in a way, I think this is a nice way to sort of just keep it also for myself so I can go back and remember how to play these songs.
Well, let's get to, so this is the title track from the brand new record, Back to the Hive 2021. Which this, like many of the songs on here, is not completely keyboard based. It has the country rock strumming acoustic thing sort of at its core. Is that sort of the other side of your, I guess you go back and forth on instruments when you're playing the Truckers and other folks like that?
Almost more than half the figuring out what to do is figuring out which of the two to sort of the song needs, you know. In the Truckers, there's already two guitar players. So generally, I start off with keyboard. Unless it's not needed, if it's a, you know, total rocker and I can't figure out some sort of swooping synth line or whatever to fill it up, I'll go to guitar. And then I try to go back and forth when I'm writing them to see which works best. This was definitely like a strummer, you know, rhythm playing. And on the recording, my friend Kevin Lane played the acoustic guitar and his brother Matt, I played with them in the Possibilities along with Chris Graham, the producer and engineer. And they played it and I played bass on this particular track.
All right. Do you want to say a little about where you were at with this? So this is your second full album. The Bittersweet was sort of an EP in the middle of that. And you've done a few other releases. I want to say a little about where you're at with this album and the song that we're about to hear.
Sure. We've been working on it for a little bit, but when the pandemic hit, we really were able to sort of focus on it and only this, you know, for months and finished it by the end of this past year and just self-releasing on Bandcamp on my own label. Yeah, and this is the title cut, Back to the Hive.
I know, I may not show it, but I thought you ought to know. Oh, oh, it's like cutting off my right hand and sending it up north. But at least I know that my hand is going where it knows it's forward. I'm sad to see you go.
So this is a nice little, it seems too easy to say Beatlesque, but it's such a nice, compact, I guess some almost Orbison-y harmonies in it.
Sure. In particular, the coda, I always thought I was just lifting it directly from the Love and Spoonful, maybe, but I think it's more the feel of that, like sort of, it switches to a swung feel and that kind of John Sebastian feel good thing. So it's more of a straight taut sort of feeling for the most of the song. And then it kind of just breaks into this feel good late 60s kind of thing.
In the chorus, you know, before that later swing part, it sounds like it's opening up because you've had these kind of nasty B sus two chords. I think I just call them modal, cutting off my right hand, sending it up north. And then it opens up into this, I'm happy to see that you're going, but I'm sad to see you go. But it actually does have a little bit in some of the note choices that sad to see, and especially the first time you say C, it's sort of weirdly sustained so that when you repeat it, it can be over the pretty chord. You're actually making it a little bit sad in the happy part.
But at least your coop is calling you right back to where you.
Completely subconsciously, I'd imagine that I didn't think of that at the time, but I, you know, kind of learned to trust the subconscious with that. And I found looking back at stuff that it ends up, maybe it's just repetition when I sing about, you know, the melody goes up and down. I think it's just the way it goes. But yeah, there's that B sus suspended thing has that weird sort of farfisa angular thing and just holding that tension throughout it. I always thought it was kind of a Burt Bacharach kind of nanner, 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 like, but not as smooth as Burt would have done it, you know?
Well, and it's got even before, so I guess that really weird farfisa thing doesn't come into the second verse when you're doing that. But even in the first verse, it kind of answers with this little claves or, you know, it has a little kind of tango thing just for like two measures there.
It's like cutting off my right hand and sending it up north.
Yeah, it's just a little response kind of thing with like a swish and a clave click, you know. It was Chris's idea to kind of hold off and bring it in later the second time. And it really kind of adds a little more tension for the second time. We definitely try to do that a bit, hold stuff off as long as possible and then give some little surprises. But yeah, it's interesting because it comes in and then the percussion thing happens the first time and then it doesn't repeat it as the second half of that section. So again, that was just the way it happened. But looking back, it's, you know, I think it kind of works. It's just instead of beating it to death, it just sort of just have a little peek at something and pops out.
Now, just the way that the verses are articulated, like the first verse, the words are very much connected with the rhythm that you're singing it, mm-hmm. right? I know, pause. I may not show it, but I thought you ought to know. It's like cutting off my right hand, sending it up north. Whereas the second verse, it's your pause, homing pit. Like,
right.
You wouldn't put a pause there if you were just saying that. So what's the order of operations there? I mean, I like the overall effect, but some of the lines there, your sonar screaming wrong. Like, I don't think until I saw it written down, I even could kind of hear what was being said because it was sort of sacrificing the meaning to the melody.
Yeah, I tend to do that. I don't think I wrote the melody before I think a lot of times I end up writing the first verse and the chorus and then coming back and finishing it. I'm sure that's what happened with this. This is an old one, probably 2005 or 2006 or something like that. And this album has, you know, I Want to Hold You is like 20 years old, if not older. And then the last instrumental, Rosa, is less than a year old. So it wasn't an intentional spanning thing, but it was almost like picking songs that I'd never really recorded or maybe demoed and wanted to try to match, chase the demo kind of thing. But for this one, yeah, the second verse, I think I was just trying to match the template of the first verse. But there was a little bit of a pause just to make the lyric fit. It's more important for the melody and the lyric to scan musically than make sense, I guess. You know, it's that alliteration, sonar screaming wrong. It's just like, oh, wow. It's
well, you got the nice slide on wrong there.
Sonar screaming wrong.
I love those melismas that jump pretty far, fifth or whatever, you know.
I wanted to call attention to, I think it's the second time the chorus happens. Just that one note piano thing I love as a little overdub. Dun, 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 dun.
I call it the submarine, especially when it's on a, like the sonar thing. It's on the Wurlitzer. And I use that trick more often than I'd like to admit with the Truckers and with older songs of mine. But there's something about having that pedal point up high kind of that just, I think it's actually on Need You Round as well, the later song on the album, but that's on the other side of the album, so it's okay. But there's a tension there and a focus that while everything's moving around underneath it.
So you said Kevin was playing this acoustic guitar solo that comes in after that, is that right?
Well, he played the acoustic rhythm part.
Okay.
I ended up doing that on a nylon string, trying to do a, you know, And I Love Her kind of.
Yeah, that was the part that sounded the most Beatle-y to me. I was a little surprised that you kind of let the verse go its full length because it's tense there for a while. And for the nice little And I Love Her, like I'd have to go back, but I feel like probably even it would be typical for a Beatles song that does that to contract it. You've gotten the idea. Move along.
I can't go back and edit it now. What am I going to? It's already mastered. But yeah, it goes throughout the whole thing. An example that of another one that goes even longer than that is Gilbert O'Sullivan's, what is his big hit? Oh, Alone Again Naturally. I think it's Big Jim Sullivan does the nylon string solo and it goes through the whole verse and it's even longer than this. And it's like, it is one of those things you're like, it's a little long, but I can hang with it, you know? And especially there's something about like an electric guitar, you can sustain it and you can do vibrato and stuff. But it's like with that nylon, it's just like, you got to keep picking it. Otherwise it just dies out.
It's of course a very nicely constructed solo and it retains that tastefulness. But given that you had that extra length, I think if I were recording this, I would feel nervous about that. And like, oh, let's, when we repeat it the second time, let's overdub an octave or, you know, just like do something to stack it to kind of,
yeah,
if you're going to have tension, then build it there.
It's doubled an octave up at the very last run. I'm sure at that point I was like, what can I do to make this? It's only on the very last phrase and it's mixed kind of low, but it was just like, it's got to pick up somewhere.
And then we finally have this coda, Back to the Bustle to the Howl of the Hive, where you go all swing, but it's just quarter notes to start with. You know, we're just going to tramp through it. And then what was your feeling? Well, you call this final chord C triangle. What is that? What does that even mean?
That's, some fake books will use that. I think it's frowned upon because F triangle, or whatever, but C triangle. But yeah, it's that real just happy 60s spoonful sounding chord.
Was it spoonful that was influencing the choice of harmony vocal notes? Like this is a kind of a very specific, not Beatles-y dissonance through some of it.
I mean, yeah, they did some harmony stuff like that. And yeah, I guess so. I mean,
in the last couple albums.
They sort of fleshed stuff out a lot later on. But yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking from the get go with that section and the drums like Matt Lane plays. He's got this great behind the beat feel and the swinging on it and the fills. It's just like, I think it's a lot like modern drummers don't really have that as much these days. That sort of like, all the drummers in the 60s doing rock stuff grew up with sort of like early rock and roll where it was swing and then hearing sort of jazz and R&B where it's not as metronomic, it's just more of a circular feel. And he really nails it on that.
And why is a pigeon going back to a hive?
Yeah, that's called mixed metaphors, I believe. I mean, that's an example of maybe editing would have been a good. It's a friend of mine moved back to New York, and he's going back to the hive. And again, that's the second verse where it's like, I think I beat the bee imagery to death with it,
So your friend is your right hand that you're sending up north? Is that what you mean? Okay.
Yeah, he's the guy. He's the
not I'm cutting off my ear. Not that kind of sentiment.
No. It's like we work together on music all this time and he's going home, but it's tough. We're all from up in New York, and I moved here with a band in the mid 90s and three of us ended up sticking around the general area and he moved back to New York because he's probably the only true New Yorker of us all. He grew up near the city and in the city and we were all suburbanites and Long Islanders and Buffalo people and stuff. So
I want to stop for a minute for some sponsor messages. The first of which is, of course, about Masterclass, where you can learn from the world's best minds anytime, anywhere at your own pace. You can learn about science from Neil deGrasse Tyson, conservation from Jane Goodall, journalism from Bob Woodward, cooking from Gordon Ramsay, photography, interior design, business strategy. The list goes on, including, of course, over a dozen music classes from folks ranging from Alicia Keys and St. Vincent to Itzhak Perlman and Danny Elfman. My most recent experience with Masterclass was listening to the entirety of Aaron Sorkin Teaches Screenwriting for a Pretty Much Pop episode I was recording, which not only was hugely useful for that endeavor, but there's always things that I learn from courses like this about constructing a piece of entertainment, about people's attention spans, about how to construct a narrative, lessons that help for good songwriting. I took in that course as a purely audio experience. You can choose that as an option or video. Listen to it double speed, and I did the whole thing in an evening. So you can do it that way, or you can do it the way I've done some of the music classes, where you use the downloadable lesson recaps and supplemental materials, where you use the ability to chat with other folks that are experiencing the class, where I stream it to the TV to share with my family. Whatever you're interested in, and at whatever level, there's a masterclass for you with 100+ exclusive classes taught by the masters you love. So I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every masterclass. And as a Nakedly Examined Music listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/examined. That's masterclass.com/examined for a 15% off masterclass. I also want to tell you about the Nebbia by Moen Spa Shower. Now, I don't know about you, but the shower is one of my favorite places to be. I stand in there and think, and this can waste water. And with an ordinary shower, really, it's my back that is hot, and I kind of have to keep shuffling around. But with the Nebbia by Moen Spa Shower, you use 45% less water, and yet, the spray is 81% more powerful than the competition. By atomizing the water, this cutting-edge shower head heats up the environment of your shower. The whole thing feels like a spa, thus the name. It was designed by brilliant people who used to work for Tesla, NASA, and Apple. Is a truly luxurious experience, well-designed. It moves up and down, has four different finishes. It has a little wand you can use to wash your feet. This could be a really nice thing to install for Mother's Day. And as I said, there's a lot of water savings. You can actually calculate your savings on their website, and you'll see that it pays for itself in less than a year. It is easy to install. There are good instructions and video to just walk you right through it. They have great support. The Nebbia by Moen Spa Shower starts at just $199. And for Nakedly Examined Music listeners, we have a deal for you. The first 100 people to use the code NEM at Nebbia.com will get 15% off all Nebbia products. That's not just the shower, but they have very cool shower curtain made from recycled water bottles. They have a bath mat made from reclaimed cotton, sustainable shower shelves, hooks, etc. Nebbia rarely does deals like this, so this is a great deal to jump on. Go to Nebbia.com/NEM. That's Nebbia.com/NEM to check out what they have to offer. The first 100 people to use the code NEM while checking out will save 15% off all Nebbia products. That's Nebbia.com/NEM. Use that code NEM to save 15%. Let's get back to it. Well, let's get the second song out there, or rather songs. You had picked ampersand, pound,
ampersand, dollar sign, percent. Yeah, I can't even.
You sing it, so if people can learn it that way. I could probably remember it.
It should have been called Powerfully Bitter is what it would have been better, but I just was being a dick.
Typing swear words on the internet is the,
yes,
the
basically
point.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was so short. So this is from Bittersweet 2015, which is an actual suite of five short songs, 13 minutes total. So we're actually going to hear the last two of them, this ampersand one, and then I just suggested at the last minute, let's go into the finale, Shinnerock Lane, which really popped for me just as I was sort of listening in the background. There were just things about the, when that, I don't want to say the head, but the title, when you actually say the name of the song,
sure,
and it spins out, you know, sort of as a thing that ends up being the closer, there's just something very powerful and spooky about that. So I wanted to go ahead and extend this, you know, from a 2-minute song to a 5-minute song, which it's still.
Yeah, still short.
But this is nearly half of a suite. Do you want to say a little about the suite and these portions of it? They're obviously musically very related. It doesn't seem thematically they're obviously related. I did listen to the whole suite today in a row just to kind of get the feeling. It didn't jump out to me as a thematically, lyrically unified thing. Is that?
Yeah, I think it's a little less like A Quick One While He's Away by The Who, where it's like a disconnected or any sort of like rock opera, or and more, again, the Beatles, but like, you know, the Abbey Road kind of second side. Like, it was five separate songs that I had, and I just tried to figure out what order to put them in, and then, you know, took the introduction at the beginning and tacked it on at the end to try to, you know, make it as cohesive as possible. And these two songs, out of all five of them, are in the same key, and they share similar tonalities and not vibes. I mean, one is very upbeat and angry, and then the other one's kind of resigned and sad, which have a tendency to end albums on that note.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this starts off, I guess the interesting thing is a suite. I was sort of listening when I was listening to it, the whole thing straight. I'm like, okay, is it going to be the fast song, then the slow song, then the fast song or something, you know, like a classical suite would be.
Sure.
But no, there's actually movement within all of them. They're actually all more like show tunes, but with the same kind of shifts that we even had in Back to the Hive, that we had this almost a separate song smacked on as the coda here. So yes, this starts fast, but by the time it gets to the chorus, it's like weary. It's
it is about, you know, the sort of internet troll kind of mentality, you know, and yeah, instead of yelling the cuss words, it's just a little more, yeah, resigned. Then at the end, I think that's what led me to lead it into Shinnerock Lane, which has that same tempo. I think the whole suite is more of a medley or an overture to a show or something than an actual suite. I just can't resist a pun. And I think, you know, of course, there's a few bittersweets out there.
If you're talking about internet trolls, I'm satirizing other people, but I hear it's in the first person. It does sound like it's hard to control that.
I mean, it was definitely something I dealt with personally, but it's easier to put yourself in the first person to kind of see where they're coming from a little bit.
Okay,
you know?
So you've just been on the receiving end of this. I don't know, maybe it's sort of a beginner thing. Whenever you happen to get introduced to the internet or a new form of the internet, then at least once it's hard not to be tempted to respond or say something that later you were like, who is that actually for? That benefited no one.
No, it's just this like feedback loop of the negativity, you know, and you see it now politically, especially and stuff. And in particular, you know, Drive-By Truckers, fairly open political band at this point. And sometimes it's just amazing what some folks will say on the Facebook. You know, it's always don't read the comments. There's that moment of trying not to engage and the anger. And then you're like, I'm going to type this. And fortunately, my wife's usually there and she's like, it's not, just don't do it. If you communicate through messaging personally, the minute it's like out in the open in front of people, it tends to sink pretty fast into nastiness and stuff. So,
but why would you be, if somebody's complaining about the Drive-By Truckers being too liberal or something, they're not going to be like, and the keyboardist.
That's an example of mostly just what I see. I mean, you know, we had a Black Lives Matter poster on the organ since 2016, that tour. And because it's on the organ, I would often get confronted about it. And I don't feel like it needs to be explained or rationalized. It's what we believe. And when that would happen in person, it was always like, so I was just curious. Like, it wasn't like this, like, I can't believe you just hear the clacking of the keys. You know, when someone's in their basement or whatever, typing away, it's so much easier to be just nasty, you know? And that's the other thing. It's the sort of anonymity of it. It's happened forever. I'm sure in publications and stuff like that, newspapers. But I mean, with the internet, it's just so easy to do. It's like forums. I love like guitar forums and nerdy sort of music forums and stuff. But it's just like everybody's got an opinion and they know exactly what's right about it. And I think it was, I was typing on the computer, writing the lyrics, and was just like the bridge. I was just trying to fit it in as many stupid puns, you know, like barring, you know, space bar, like just trying to fit every, since I already got the ampersand dollar sign, percent at pound exclamation point in the chorus. I was like, well, why not space bar, like spacing out and keeping tabs and stuff like that. It was just like, this was way more for being such a personal song. It was a very like almost Broadway sort of had a certain form to it, you know?
I think that's one of the most desirable skills. Like I can fake keyboards. I have one behind me on my own recordings. But what I don't know how to do easily is turn a melody, like you were just singing, into a really damn cool, you know, 2-3 note harmony thing that has that classic. Is this a Rhodes?
It's a Hohner pianette. It's like what the Zombies used on She's Not There and all the early stuff. That sort of sound, it's a little brighter than a Wurlitzer, so it kind of fit. It was almost like a piano-y brightness to it.
Well, it's got that nice kind of static on the attack or the release or something that makes
it
sound
old. But
that's
why I love that. I've been obsessed with that sound forever. It's on, you know, it's on the Help album. I think on You're Gonna Lose That Girl. And These Eyes by the Guess Who. It's like, and Chris, my buddy I work with, founded it, one up there in Brooklyn. And the basis of this whole album was supposed to be, you know, to be performed by our band without having like a bunch of overdubs. So it's like, I think it's pan to the right, the keyboard, and then it's just one guitar to the left and one to the right, bass and drums for the majority of it. And then there's some overdubs, but it just so I could play it live with a band back when you could play live with a band. And we did it. And we played it about 2 or 3 shows like straight through and never fell apart. It's fun to play. You just got to make sure you're ready for it before it starts. beats, you know?
So I think that just knowing how to, without thinking of it, that's like one of the early keys, a secret sauce to becoming like the useful sideman keyboard player, is just to be able to take any given melody and, oh yeah, sure, I don't have to write out anything. I can add a couple extra fingers and...
The key is just have your pinky on like either the octave or the fifth and then play underneath it. There's always like that sort of pedal point. But the other thing is, you know, it's basically whenever I do that kind of piano playing, I'm ripping off Floyd Kramer and then all the guys that I love from the 60s and 70s, like Nicky Hopkins and Elton John and Billy Joel, all those guys, that slip piano thing where you slip up to the third or the sixth from the five, in like, that's just mimicking the bending on a guitar, basically, or sliding up. Just listen to like every Floyd Kramer song and it makes sense all of a sudden. Even the theme to Dallas, if you can do it, if you can sit through it.
Is there a particular thing that you were like, okay, I'm channeling this in just in the... I'm so powerful in here.
I just can't control... This one I really felt like it was like an early Joe Jackson Band kind of thing, because it's real stripped down, especially in the chorus part. But yeah, that sort of pompous, bombastic thing. I think it's simultaneously hilarious, but also I really do feel it. Like when I listen to you, I hear the music, you know, the end of Tommy, when it goes into that section, I still like get chills, you know. And the story, you know, it's not so much about the story. It's just the feel, that majestic thing that The Who had in particular, and a lot of power pop bands kind of really lifted that. I can't seem to help but do that.
Well, I like that the bass retains that rhythm in the choruses, even though we're not being bombastic anymore. It still has boom, boom. Were you playing bass on this one, or did you kind of dictate that rhythm?
I was. I played bass on this one. This one I kind of demoed in Pro Tools with like a click, and like I programmed all the clicks to speed up and slow down and everything. This is like too much of the how the sausage is made. But it's because you wanted it to just sound like a live thing. And then we went and recorded my friend Joe Rowe playing drums, like straight through it in the studio, and then re-recorded all the parts to fit on top. But so as most of it, Chris plays some fuzz guitar. But I played a lot of this. This was definitely more of a sort of a trying to be Emmett Rhodes or Todd Rundgren or something, or McCartney, where it's like it was written by coming up with all the parts at home.
So I assume Shinnin' Rock Lane was not added to this later?
Once I had the five songs, I just remember writing them down and then like writing the numbered order next to it, playing them through and seeing. But, you know, the connected things, like there's a little connected walk-up part going into Almond Eyes, but it's like a...
The second song going in
the third song, there's this like walk-up slow-down thing. And that was, you know, there's definitely some sort of manufactured connectors going on. But I think, you know, it's so natural to go from Powerfully Bitter into Shinnin' Rock Lane because it just ends on that, the same rhythm. And then it just quiets down even more to a sort of solo keyboard.
But then clearly thematically, like you've moved on to a different thing with one of these Penny Lane-ish like story of old people in a house and then, you know, family, domestic.
Totally. And it was connected in the sense that it all happened at the same time, going to my grandfather's funeral and all this drama was happening back home. And so it's like, you know, in my head, it all makes sense, but it certainly leaves a lot for interpretation.
Having this, what is this, in 6/8? Shinnin' Rock Lane, late afternoon. Family sits in the front room. Cousins, they play with the littlest one, but something is wrong with the prodigy. It probably evens out to 4/4 when you're done.
I think it's like two bars of three and then a two, like a bup, bup, and that's cutting off that one little beat helps move it forward. But it really, again, I don't think it was something I counted. Throwing a 2/4 bar in there, usually it's like, it's just a way to shorten the boring chunk in between. It's almost like a Latin kind of thing, like the bup, 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 but like, I want to live in America kind of, you know, that sort of thing, which, you know, Springsteen got from like Aaron Copland. And I love that real rhythmic thing that happened kind of mid-century, 20th century.
Right. So then we have the fast version of that pretty soon after that, I think. So the bridge, 57 seconds. Okay, actually not that much faster, but still growing. We've added some drums and things, kind of using that to build tension. I mean, it's not da-da-da, live in America, because that has to be the thing that you're staying on, right? That's the dance point, whereas this is more like we're adding something to raise a little tension, and then we're going to go back down to something more ordinary rhythmically.
It's definitely using that sort of military drum beat to build up the tension. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da. you know, it might still have the same rhythm if, or maybe I changed it a little bit, but then it's definitely building up the tension that much more just to have that release of that next instrumental section.
Yeah. So is that a accordion or something?
It's overdubbed melodica, you know, the,
oh yeah, okay,
the piano you blow into, and it's basically a small accordion. Yeah. I was trying to, again, think of like things that I could easily bring on stage and do, you know, and I, when we had enough folks, you know, my friend Peter Alvinos, he do all the sort of supplemental percussion and that and everything. And so it's while we kind of held down the rhythm parts and stuff.
But yet at the very end of the song, you introduce what this like extra circus organ or something overdubbed, and the spooky theremin sound that was at the beginning of the whole suite comes back. So you could do that even in the live setting? That was part of that plan, or that was...
I think we were like super technical at that point, and like by having like an iPad with, you know, a free looping system. So I had someone hitting the loops, and we may have skipped it in certain performances, but I think it was easy enough to just loop that. And the only thing is it's in a different key from the beginning. So had to have two loops, you know. I'm glad I figured it out before we kind of tried it. But yeah, that's a saw. You know, Athens back in the day with bands like Neutral Milk Hotel, Julian Koster played the saw, and that was the first time I had heard anybody playing the musical saw, and just kind of blew my mind. And so I kind of started trying to learn it, you know, and it's again, it's like almost as hard as a theremin, I'd imagine, just because you can't see where it's going and you have to kind of find the pitch. But when you double track it like that, it kind of gives it a little leeway. And so I just, that's from another song completely. And I just cut it and it kind of happened to fit in. I like the idea of like sampling your own stuff so you don't have to pay for anything.
Well, let's talk about that central chorus thing. Let me just play it 41 seconds. Is it introduced a second keyboard here, or you're just playing them two keyboards with different hands?
The piano part, the electric piano part, is doing the sort of eighth notes, the driving thing. And then I bring in it's like a Hammond B3, but like more of that circusy kind of setting where you have like all the drawbars pulled out, but maybe halfway or something. And so it has this real rich sort of, the Leslie speaker is spinning fast and it has like the vibrato on it. It's just like everything, literally all stops pulled out and doing a sort of repetitive arpeggio thing over it. I knew it was going to be kind of repeating this and fading. So I was like trying to think of how many things we can throw on there without it getting too cluttered, you know, and then the backup vocals kind of come in and respond.
Just that initial, the lead vocal line, shall not lay, just crashing wave thing that is sort of the, you know, the thing that made my ears perk up initially. Was that the center first part of the song that was written, or was that just like a happy accident that you were able to have it develop that way?
It wasn't one of the first things that came out. I kind of knew it was going to be a repeating thing just on the title. I'm saying this like I can remember. I mean, this is 5-6 years ago. I can't remember yesterday, but Back to the Hive, the song we played earlier. I mean, I put a code on it. I'm a fan of sort of like having a slightly different thing at the end, or you know, repeating. And then also, you know, sort of a sweeping, I love sweeping melodies, you know, like Sleepwalk or something like that. I, you know, I was trying to do a, it certainly has like kind of a wistful, melancholy thing going on, you know, as it fades out, because it's a sad song. So it seemed logical to do that.
Comparing that in my head to other songs that where the chorus is, again, like a phrase that is repeated, but that's the thing that's supposed to be the release of tension, not this nice wistful waves on, like, it's really hard to get a good song like that. I feel like I have a lot of albums from the 80s where there's at least one song that's, now my mind is going to Spinal Tap, Sex Farm, where I think that Sex Farm, Hell Farm, or just like, okay. But this one is like chock full of stuff, even though it only has the one line. You're not only moving that around, but you've got this really kind of busy answering part on the keyboard, which then you do fill with background vocals later in the song. So there's plenty of musical material there. You're not just relying on this being a hook.
It's so repetitive. I mean, it's the exact same thing over and over again that it's like, yeah, there needed to be some window dressing in my head anyway. I mean, I tend to kind of overdo it with that stuff, I think, in ways I like counter melodies more than melodies, but it's, that might be the being a side guy sort of job that I have. I sort of do that a lot, but yeah, it just seemed to be the way to go with this and, you know, have a slow fade and then bring back the saw, synthy sounding thing.
Slow fade, so repetitive, such excess. We've reached 3 minutes and 9 seconds. What a sprawling epic this is.
That's the other thing, is I like to do epic stuff in a really short amount of time. I mean, I've been starting to work on like music for commercials lately, and it's like trying to fit everything into 30 seconds was a nightmare at first, but now it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, it's just there and then it's gone, you know. The whole album, not this one, this is 13 minutes, but the new album is 11 songs and it's 29 minutes, I think, total. So, you know, I'm definitely, as I get older, sort of cut out the fat and just, does it need a guitar solo? You know, it's, in the past, it was like every song had a guitar solo.
I remember reading some interview with Steve Winwood or something, and this is like 1991, you know, as he was in the middle of his resurgence of hits, and saying, oh yeah, audiences are getting more sophisticated now. You don't have to repeat the chorus so many times. I don't know if that's true. I don't, like, as far as my personal listening, you know, I like this concise kind of thing, but it is the case that your albums are immediately appealing, but like a lot of pop music, don't really sink in their talents until you've spun it three times or whatever. And I don't know if having more repetitions within a song gets you around that, or it just makes it more irritating the first time people hear it when they still are not open to it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you just go back through the top 40 lists, most hit songs tend to be pretty short. And I do think there's something to just making you come back with an earworm. And so much of making a good song / record / performance is like, you know, knowing when to stop. You know, how long do I need this overdub? How long does it need to be? Do we need this section? It's like the writing of the initial material is important, obviously, but it's like anything. I think the editing is something I've gotten better at, not just being lazy and letting stuff go, but just making sure every part, if it's going to be there, it needs to be doing something, you know?
Well, like the Back to the Bustle to the Howl of the Hive, like that is a catchy chorus, yet it's used as a coda. You know, I wrote a lot of very short songs early on. At some point, I made a little jump to, I want to have this extra structure. So I'll do verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, second chorus. And that's the really catchy one. But then I want to then do at least another like solo and have the catchy chorus again, or maybe back to a verse again. Just, and it ends up being 5 or 6 minutes. Like, you can't, if you're going to have all that structural material and you want it, you know, let people solo over it and let it go, then it's going to add up.
Yeah, it really is. And it's like, if you like with Steve Winwood, Low Spark of High Heel Boys, I love, and that's long and, you know, and stretches out for sections, but it works. You know, if you're going to have a song be 6 minutes, that has to fill out the space without just repeating all these sections. And it's just, you know, that song, it's like has such a slow tempo and slow rollout of information that it kind of works. It's, for some reason, I'm obsessed with getting stuff out really fast and then getting out of there. You know?
Well, I feel this has all been a very good prologue to the third song, Turning Me On, from your first full solo album, 2012's Mess of Happiness. Can you say a little about it? Because this is really, we will hit you with this lick and we'll keep hitting you with this lick and you're going to like it. And it's very self-consciously, the song, even the lyrics are about that, basically.
Yeah, it's a little ridiculous. I mean, it might say it 40 times in the song. I counted it once just to see the gall I had to repeat it that many times. This is the song that I probably play the most off of that album and seems to be the amongst my friends and family, the quote-unquote hit. It is. It's about, thanks for turning me on to this song. It's like that feeling of someone playing you a record or CD or, you know, sending you a link and just having your mind blown. It's like, it doesn't happen often that a song someone sends you, especially nowadays where you can just like copy a link and send it on the text. But like sometimes, you know, a whole new world is just opened up to you. If it's a relationship with a person that doesn't last your whole life, you always have that song.
Worthless, strong views.
So we get the head right up front. We get the chorus, but then these verses end up being this big swelling. I don't know. This sounds more Wings than like you're thinking more early 70s than 60s at this point with these kind of moves.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s, really, but I, you know, was formative early years, was, I'm sure, hearing Silly Love Songs or something on that. You know, I mean, I remember asking my mom when I was 5 or 6, like, you know that song, Someone's Knocking on the Door, Somebody's Ringing the, like, is that the Beatles? And she's like, no, it's not. And then years later, I found, you know, it's not the Beatles, but it's Wings, you know, and I was just like, oh my God. I just love that sort of lush 70s, you know, ELO thing.
I like the turnaround in the middle of that. Is that two distinct guitars?
Yeah, that's some guitar mini that's not quite, you know, it's not like a Thin Lizzy thing, but it's certainly from growing up and hearing the, you know, those kind of bands playing guitar harmony. But yeah, it's like fuzzy harmony guitars.
Yeah, I just like that. It's, again, it's easy to do something like that that's two beats long. But we got a full measure here that we're going to kind of do this ricocheting thing. And you better keep dancing during this.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's walking up too. It's got that weird chromatic walk up. Not weird, but that almost Nielsen. It's almost like pre-rock and roll kind of thing, you know. And, yeah. And I think that motion moving up, I think the sort of sting of those fuzz guitars is keeps it from being maybe too pretty or too hokey or something.
Well, just the fact that you have complete stops of everything.
Right.
That also, like, as much as the main riff sounds like it could be the hit single, I'm not at least thinking offhand of a lot of like giant radio songs that have multiple, the entire band stops and like.
Dramatic, man. I love that. If it works. For everyone that makes it into the song is all, you know, trying to all these different tricks that you just slowly edit out as well. If you're doing your job right, you know, which I don't always do, but it's Chris really, you know, he's sort of like the quality tester. If I can pass it by him, it's going to be good, you know, and it's always that trying to make it as stripped down as possible, even when there is a lot going on, making sure it's not cluttered. Yeah, that takes a while to do, but I like that verse because it's the tonality, the chord progression is such a different feeling than the happy swingy chorus, you know.
So this is Chris Rowe, your drummer, not...
No, I'm sorry, Chris Grand, the he mixed this, and guitarist and producer, co-producer, and he mixes everything and records everything. So it was a demo solo album, so Mess of Happiness ended up becoming an album, but I had just gotten out of a band and was playing with the Truckers and stuff. So at some point I asked for his help to sort of turn it into real tracks, and he did wonders with the drum sound, you know, on that. And it helped out a lot, making it sound cohesive. Because at that point, like now I have like a friend's real Gretsch drum kit. But at that point, I had like a side marching drum and a China cymbal hanging from a string on this. You know, it's just really bad sounds and stuff. Really just thinking it was going to be demos. And, you know, I'm glad it didn't come out like just the way I recorded it.
So he's playing those fake harmonized guitars.
Not on that. This is all kind of me just because it was like a home demo kind of thing. But he's the one who like cleaned up the drum sound and helped everything and really mixed it and really suggested taking stuff out, cleaning it up and stuff. So it was sort of the mixing and final versions are infinitely better than the way I started out. I've gotten better over the years at sort of getting decent clean sounds to send to him. But every project I've done, you know, he's been a partner.
Well, and I like what that guitar does as you get into the second verse. Is that like an actual backwards guitar?
It might be backwards. I can't remember if I flipped it, but it's a fuzz guitar going through like my uncle gave me, he had bought back in the 60s, a guitar from the back of a comic book. And the guitar, it's, you know, guitar is about a foot high. I'm sure the picture was amazing. And it's like unplayable. The amp was this 3 inches by 5 inches with fake wood wallpaper on the, you know, instead of on card. It was all cardboard. And, you know, and it's 40 years old or something, and it's just freaked out and all that, everything's dried out in it. And so it does this crazy thing where you hold a note and it jumps around and does these weird noises. So that's what that is. And all those fuzz guitars are through that. So it's not actually a pedal or a fuzz effect. It's like this little tiny amp just wanting to die, you know, just please stop using me kind of thing, which now I can't get it to work anymore. So it kind of swells, or not swells, but it swoops into the second verse, I guess.
Yes. And I'm surprised that it works toward the end of it. It's such a carefully orchestrated walk down the first time, you know, singing along with this very exposed piano thing. And the fact that then you repeat it with this kind of just going over it. And yet it's, you know, it's mixed well enough that It's fine.
It's one of those things that might not do it these days. I might be like, oh, well, it doesn't need that. But it's like, I think I enjoyed the sort of like loose, fun. The prettier the song, the more you got to kind of balance it out with nastiness, you know, to not get too sweet or sugary, you know, which it ends up doing anyway. But it's all a matter of balance, you know. The arrangement is a big part of it.
In the very early days of MP3s, not all MP3s would play correctly on all MP3 players. And a guy that had been my co-frontman in a past band sent me, we would do some goofy psychedelic stuff, but he sent me this really nice piano ballad, but it had this like kind of crackling throughout. I'm like, that is a really interesting choice. Like, no, it just was the MP3 fucking up.
Yeah, like, yeah. So I remember scratch CDs used to do like real interesting rhythmic thing. This is really fascinating. And it's just like, I think I was listening to like a friend was playing me Fugazi and I'm like, that's an interesting riff. And it was just like skipping forward over the same riff. It was like, oh man, this is, you know, it's amazing how random shit can be interesting.
Let's close out here with another one from the new album. You've released three singles for it. I Want to Hold You. You were saying this is a 20-year-old song. It's one of those ones where maybe it wasn't until the third time that I heard it that it was really like, oh, this is kicking my ass. I got to.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of innocuous. I mean, it's a real simple, strummy kind of thing. And it's just the three verses. Just there's nothing really tricky about the layout or anything like that. I think I decided to put that one first because that's the one, again, like friends and family seem to react to that one the most. You know, it's embarrassing going back because lyrically, you know, I would change some stuff. But I think it's got a nice quality to it that I can kind of handle. Still sing it.
Have you emptied out the chambers for them? It sounds like some of these songs were quite old. Is there still like another two albums worth of stuff that you're...
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, there's always a bunch of songs, you know. I've been writing... A friend of mine, Pete Smith, wrote the lyrics to two of the songs on here. He wrote all the lyrics to You Make It Hard to Be Unhappy. And I just wrote the music to that. And that's kind of a Everly Brothers duet that I sing with Chris. And then the other song is Never Felt Bad About Feeling Good. And he wrote the lyrics to that. So, but he and I have about 35 songs we've written together. And he, you know, he's primarily a lyricist and he sends me PDFs. And then I just send him the music. And it's a very like, you know, what I would imagine sort of Elton getting a pile of paper from Bernie Taupe. You know, that's in my head, that's what I'm doing, you know, or a more traditional singer, songwriter, lyricist, Tin Pan Alley kind of thing. And he's just great. It's, we're going to have a whole album, you know, Gonzalez Smith is coming up, but this was, you know, these songs fit with this so well that I had to kind of, you know, work them in. And so it really, and it also brings it up to date to me, you know, it's not all old songs. So really it's like, it spans the last 20 years. Just, you know, there's always extra songs that don't work and stuff. And even ones that there was probably four or five other songs that were going to be on here that just got cut or switched around as new ones came in. So, you know, it's tough. I used to think albums were just whatever you wrote at that time. And I'm sure it is, but you know, it's important to like keep one for this other project. Or if it's just, you know, even if it's a good song, it doesn't have the right vibe. It doesn't fit with the other ones. You know, you want it to kind of flow. So
he was in the pre-Truckers bands with you, joined the Possibilities with you, and then Nutria. Is that right? Or no?
Who is this? Oh, Chris was. Pete Smith is another dude. Yeah. I met him a few years ago and he's a producer over at Adult Swim and he came up with the Brack show and he worked on Space Ghost Coast to Coast. And he also did it's like one of those weird things. My brother-in-law is friends with his daughter and we met and talked and he was surprised that I knew so much about the music from the 60s, 50s and 60s. And his daughter, as we were leaving that night, from hanging out, said, you need to get his album. And I'm like, oh yeah, everybody's got an album, you know. But then I went and looked it up and he did an album with Gary McFarland in the early 70s called Butterscotch Rum. And my mind was blown. It's like this soft pop masterpiece. And he wrote all the lyrics and sang on it. And so we just kind of hung out and talked music and would have dinner and stuff. And then one day he sent me a song lyric and we kind of haven't stopped from there, you know. I was working on one last night, so I really enjoy that, like sort of just having the skeletons of really good lyrics and something that he writes some of the music in certain songs, but like primarily he's focusing on this, he's a storyteller, and it's just great to have like that to start with and then try to figure out how to set it musically.
All right, well, we will look for that, or I will link to anything that is existent or, you know, those particular songs.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate it, man. This is, I enjoy the show and really excited to nerd out.
All right, here's I Wanna Hold You.
I wanna hold you. I wanna hold you till you come. I across my shoulder, babble till your crying's over, fall asleep to the busy signal.
Thanks so much to Jay. That was a really fun discussion. I really appreciated his interest in the podcast, his engagement with the project. And of course, his songs are wonderful. And he doesn't have 20 albums worth of them for me to work through. You can get more information at jaygonzalez.com. That's Gonzalez with Z's instead of S's. Now, we did talk more about his pre-solo bands, pre-Drive-By Truckers bands. You can get that if you support the podcast at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. That'll be posted by Monday, April 12th. My next interview will be with Nels Klein, the lead guitarist for Wilco and a jazz guy. I've also talked recently to Steve Almas, and most recently to David Cross, who is the violinist in the 70s for King Crimson, and now runs the David Cross Band and does a lot of collaborations, an amazing progressive rock violin player, and also an actor and educator, a very sharp, interesting guy. I hope you come back for that. You can be sure to get all of these episodes if you subscribe directly to the Nakedly Examined Music feed through nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you look at the upper right corner of that page, you'll see a widget that I've put up so you can leave a review, a rating easily for the podcast that will go to iTunes or Podchaser or CastBox. Please take advantage of that. I also want to call attention to my other podcast, Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast. I put up an episode recently there on rock and roll autobiographies with guest Laura Davis, who has appeared on this podcast. So you might like that. I hope you are getting vaccinated. I'm scheduled this Saturday to drive over an hour to get a single shot because I cannot wait to get out to, well, what music venues still exist, start doing band stuff again, maybe play a show or two, who knows? But in whatever form, keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lissamore signing off.